Hey everyone, if you are listening to this from our Star Wars with Aaron and Polly feed, this is actually an episode of Funny Books with Aaron and Polly, which is also available through your favorite podcast provider. However, in this episode, we start with our conversation and discussion about Star Wars The Acolyte Episode 3, Destiny. So if you like what you hear, continue listening on through the rest of the podcast to hear us talk about the latest in comic book news and releases. And if you're interested in more Funny Books with Aaron and Polly, why don't you go ahead and subscribe to Funny Books with Aaron and Polly through your favorite podcast provider. Enjoy the show. This is Paul.
This is Wayne.
And I am Andrew.
Well, it's exciting to have you boys back. You know, it was just Paul and I last week and, you know, doing a whole Star Wars with Aaron and Polly thing. And now we're back. It's the whole Funny Books crew right here in your ears.
It's good to be back after my communication difficulties, after I was jammed last week by foreign powers. It's good to be back.
You got to keep your communication droids updated.
I had a rare chance of listening to the podcast because I don't listen if I'm on it. But I listen to you guys.
If you're on it either, Wayne, just to be fair.
Yeah, because, I mean, you edit it, and we know that you don't actually edit.
No. I trim out the beginning, I trim out the end, I throw on some theme music, and we're good. We're good to go. But, yeah, no, it was sad because the Star Wars The Acolyte is so prevalent on my social media feed. You would think it's the only news item that's happened in the last week. So it was just me and Aaron discussing all the things, things Star Wars.
It is the only thing that's happening. There's no other business. It's just all Star Wars The Acolyte all the time.
I mean, if you're an X subscriber, I feel like that's true.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. You guys have mentioned that usually when they do the first two episodes, it's because the first episode isn't very good. One of the other things I've noticed about some of these shows is that episode 3 will be the flashback episode.
The flashback episode.
Yeah.
And that's another reason why they don't do, you know, why they do the first two and then they leave the episode 3 for a standalone afterwards.
Well, I guess let's talk about it. So episode 3 of The Acolyte, Destiny, came out this week. And if you thought the first two episodes were controversial, people, this third episode turned Star Wars social media on its head.
How is it controversial?
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask.
This one?
Because I don't visit Twitter or the X or whatever you want to call it, you know, except maybe once a week to see if we've got any DMs or something. But so I don't hang there much. So tell me, Paul, tell me what new toxic messages are out there?
Exactly. You know, sometimes being on Star Wars, you know, Facebook groups or looking at the never look at the comments is basically the advice I would have
True.
For people because, True. You know, the toxic fandom, the vocal toxic fandom really just kind of turns you off of like, why? Wait, why am I a fan of this? Why, you know, are these the people that I'm fans with? The toxic fandom this week was all up in arms about this week's episode of Star Wars The Acolyte because it featured a same-sex relationship and diversity and a new look at how others in the universe feel about the Force that's different than how the Jedi feel about the Force. So, you know, and it featured an Immaculate Conception, which people felt, you know, and let me clarify. So it did not feature an Immaculate Conception.
Okay, so let's unpack that. The same-sex relationship, I'm going to guess, is between I'm terrible at the names.
Oh, Shanbei's mother. That's the mother, I guess we'll just call her.
Yeah, mothers.
The well, and But I mean, we didn't establish that that was a romantic relationship.
Right? It was just a hand on a cheek, and I feel like that could have been anything, but yeah. You know, people just kind of assume.
I mean, I read it that it was an experiment. I didn't read it as, I mean, not that I'm saying there's anything wrong with a same-sex relationship, but it did not even occur to me that that was a romantic relationship.
Oh, I thought it was obvious. I mean, they described themselves as her parent, the children's parents. It completely seemed romantic to me. I mean,
it did to me as well, but obviously, you know, we're pretty open-minded on this podcast, and it didn't, I mean, it like, I'm like, okay, I didn't give it a second thought.
Right.
So the characters in the name are Coral and Mother Anisea.
Yeah.
Were the characters we're referring to, which may or may not have had a romantic relationship. It's really not given much time or context beyond.
Yeah. It really didn't read to me at all, but, you know, whatever.
Well, and these what was people the other who, thing? Well, hold on. The people who are outraged about this weren't paying attention earlier because, you know, when they were talking, when Saul was talking to her about the fire, he said that killed your mothers, you know, plural. Yeah. So whether that's, you know,
people are just outraged to be outraged. You know, it's the toxic fandom that doesn't want diversity in Star Wars. No credence to their opinion as it relates to that. If I'm being honest,
the Immaculate Conception thing, we don't know how.
Yeah, we don't know.
And that's my thing. We don't know. All they said is we created her. Yeah, right.
It could be an absentee father. Could be that she
could be genetic engineering.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, I honestly took it as genetic because when they said you created her, I carried her. I kind of took. I mean, Star Wars is literally littered with clones. I kind of assumed that maybe they were clones.
Yeah,
that's of what Mother and Asaya.
Yeah.
So it was just don't read the comments is my advice. Form your own opinion on Star Wars The Acolyte because for what it's worth, I didn't love this episode, but I didn't dislike it.
I thought this episode kind of posed some interesting questions. You know, like the whole Jedi thing of we go out and we test kids and that's our right. We can test anybody's kids we want to test, whether the parents want us to or not. It's our right, right? Yeah. And that if they pass the test, we're taking your kids.
I kind of love that about it, because it's kind of, for me, especially for people who have watched the original trilogy, mm-hmm. The Jedi were not really good people, right? You know, I mean, they saved Anakin, but literally turned a blind eye to the fact that his mom was a slave, right?
At no point in the, following 18 years, did they ever say, hey, you know, maybe we ought to go back to Tatooine and get Anakin's mom. That's a thing we could do.
I mean, one, Qui-Gon did want to rescue both of them, could only save one. And the mom wanted him to save Anakin, not her, if there had to be a choice. And then secondly, the Jedi are kind of dicks. They would have, as an organization, they're kind of dicks. And they would have probably looked at it as, well, bringing Anakin's mom out of Tatooine is going to forge this deeper connection in Anakin.
That's exactly it.
Yeah. Which the whole thing is, they want their children young so they don't have so much attachment so they can be kind of molded more in the Jedi image.
So can we pause on that point? Because I want to make a very stern I want to make an observation about what you just said, Andrew, because I agree. Mm-hmm. So Jen watches a lot of my girlfriend watches a lot of documentaries about cults.
And I'm like,
that's the definition. And she's like, no, this cult's, all about Jesus. I'm like, oh, I didn't think cults were about Jesus. She's like, they can be, really. I'm like, then what defines a cult? And she's like, it's really about the fact that your membership includes at the exception of anybody else in your life who is not part of the cult. And I'm like, whoa. This sounds kind of like the Jedi.
The Jedi, absolutely.
Very culty, right? Yeah. Like, you can be here, but you can't have any attachments to your parents or your previous life. You only are here with us.
And there's no questioning the Order's wisdom.
Right, where I teach you everything you need to know and where I give you everything you need to do your job, and you're going to listen only to us.
You're not going to have much of a life. You're going to follow the prescripts of the Order. And without getting to entertain any of your own desires or wishes.
Yep. And then you are going to recruit others as well.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Yeah, you're going to go on these missions where you walk around and you test other children to see if they're going to join us as well.
Yeah. And you're going to put them in your van.
I did find that interesting because people have talked about, well, the Jedi steal children for a while. They were pretty clear in the episode that there was a choice after the test. They have no choice about getting tested.
Right.
But after that's how the test, there was a choice.
But here's the thing. Was there a choice? Because I feel like part of the mystery is, you know, so in this episode, the Jedi give Osha and Mei, the twin sisters, you know, who are the daughters of Mother Anisea, or clones or whatever they are, you know, they give them the test. And basically Mei, who's the bad twin, you know, like fails it intentionally. And Osha's like, I want to be a Jedi. So she passes the test and they're like, OK, you passed the test.
Hold on, if you want to be a Jedi. Huh. Hold on, Paul, did you say that Mei's the bad twin because she doesn't want to be abducted by the Jedi cult?
In the context of the show, she's the bad twin.
But yeah, no. Mei is naturally the bad twin. She's just making the right choice there.
That's fair. Right. Because it's because, I mean, 5 minutes later, she's like, Osha, you can't go. I'm going to kill you. So I do feel like she's the bad twin. You know, but, you know, then they kind of separate and something happens off camera which all of the witches of this order. And I unfortunately, I don't remember the name of the order.
They be dead.
Yeah, they were killed. And I'm like,
the witches of Dathomir, some sect or splinter of the witches of Dathomir.
No way that fire killed them and brought that down.
Exactly. So right.
Did the Jedi kill them? Is that the mystery that, you know, we were like, oh, well, she was given a choice. But was she really? Did the Jedi go in and kill them? And that's kind of the mystery at play in the show, and why Mei is seeking revenge on Jedi.
I feel pretty strongly like the Jedi came in and wiped them out. Except I don't think that her mentor
Saul.
Yeah, I don't think he knew.
I think he knew. I think that's going to be the surprise of the show.
The thing is that obviously something happened because of the Jedi are so tortured by guilt. The surviving Jedi from that experience are so tortured by that Torben's like, you know, willing to, you know, poison and kill himself in order for Mei's forgiveness. Right. So the Jedi definitely do something. My personal theory is that they showed up to collect Osha. And then there was some sort of confrontation led to some sort of fight.
Well, I feel like there was a confrontation going on with the witches because, you know, they had all moved on to have a conversation about Osha's desire to leave. And I suspect that there was some sort of conflict going on. And then when the Jedi show up, it just made it more explosive. Yeah.
One of the things I found interesting that I didn't know was apparently it is illegal to train children in the Force if you are not the Jedi.
Yeah, who decides that law? The Jedi?
They made it clear that this planet they are on is outside of the Republic, right? So Republic laws shouldn't apply, but the Jedi, obviously, they reference some higher regulations. Yeah. Like, uh-huh. We can test everybody, even here on this non-Republic planet. We get to test people. I enjoyed this one to pick up on what Paul said. I anything time you bring the witches of Dathomir out, whether it be in Ahsoka or here or anywhere, I really enjoy them.
I have to say that there was a huge gaping absence of a key story point in this episode that it just bothered me that we never got to see it. I thought it was just conspicuous in its absence. And I think it was a real fault of the storytelling. And that is the very hot, witch orgy that, of course, is part of the ceremony.
Well, they were interrupted because the Jedi showed up.
It was orgy interruptus, and I don't care for it.
Knowing what Aaron wanted out of this episode before knowing it was a flashback, I really thought Aaron was going to say there was a severe shortage of hot Wookiee Jedi.
Well, he'll be back next episode.
And that was a little bit of a tease. And at end of episode 2, you see the Wookiee Jedi. Yeah. And then episode 3, no Wookiee Jedi, really. You know, you see him a little bit in the flashback, but really, no Wookiee Jedi.
I do love the, there are no children here, we swear. And then, you know, just the Wookiee looking over there. Well, what about those kids?
Well, if actually had just stayed back and stayed hidden, you know, they probably could have avoided all of this.
That's right. That's
yeah.
right. Stupid yeah. OSHA.
So I got to say, honestly, the only thing is I felt it, you know, I feel like, and I mentioned this last week, I do feel like Acolyte feels like a TV series. Like the scene in which they are performing the Ascension ceremony and they're doing like the chant, like all are one, all are many, or whatever it was. I was like, eh, that's a little cheesy. But other than that, I mean, I wouldn't say, again, like we said last week, I wouldn't say it's appointment television, but I would say I'm intrigued at the mystery, especially if it's going the way that we think it is. I like that they're doing, you know, they're doing a different take. Right. That yeah. they're that the Jedi, you know, at some point in their existence, you know, were not benevolent and are doing, you know, are willing to recruit at all costs. If that's
were they ever really benevolent?
Yeah. No. Well, the thing is, I think the Jedi are more lawful neutral than lawful good.
Yeah, I would agree.
Because they're very into the laws and following the rules. But sometimes, morally speaking, what they do maybe isn't necessarily good. But the one thing that really disappointed me in this episode is young Saul's hair is atrocious.
See, the one thing that's disappointed me so far is I want to see a younger Yoda.
I'm surprised we haven't yet.
My wife and I were talking about the timeline and in relation to the prequels. And they're like, you know, Yoda's alive somewhere.
Yeah, you know? He's at the council. I mean, this is only 100 years, and they're on Coruscant. So, you know, maybe there will be more flashback to when they bring OSHA to Coruscant.
Do you think Acolyte era Yoda has like a full head of hair?
A pompadour.
That's pompadour, exactly what yes. I was thinking. He's probably wearing sunglasses, smokes a cigarette.
Yeah, because he's only 800, not 900 right. at that point. Right.
You know, he's you know, he is, you know, swinging single out on the town Jedi. Oh, yeah.
This is off topic, but I saw, you know, a random social media thing. It was two Jedi like in a trench. There was two stormtroopers in a trench and they're seeing a Jedi from a distance, you know, face off against the whole squad. And the younger guy's just the rookie stormtrooper's just horrified at what the Jedi is doing to this squad of troopers. And the older guy's like, wait till I tell you about the little green guy. Anyway, go on.
Yeah. I enjoyed episode 3. I was entertained.
Yeah,
I liked too. It better than the first episode. So
we know what I enjoyed.
Yes, sir.
Dick Tracy number 1, but regrettably I failed to read Dick Tracy number 2.
Same. I did not read number 2 either, despite the fact that you know, we got hooked up with a copy of it. But I forgot all about it last night.
You know, the Mad Cave Studios, I'm sure they've been around a while, but they are new to me. And they really kind of came across my radar because years ago, or you know, a few years back, it was announced that they were going to be doing there was a Dick Tracy miniseries coming from I don't remember the company. Maybe it was Archie Comics or someone was going to produce like a Dick Tracy year one and it fell through. And then, you know, all of a sudden this Mad Cave Studios had the right to produce Dick Tracy comics. And I, you know, anyone who's listened to the podcast for a while knows I love pulp characters. I love that era of superhero or heroic storytelling. So I love Dick Tracy and characters like that. And, so Mad Cave Studios, you know, they're kind of doing something different with Dick Tracy in that they're not publishing it through Comixology. You know, they are publishing it in print primarily, but they have a deal where, you know, on their website you can subscribe to Dick Tracy digitally. And so you'll receive all the issues digitally. And then when the miniseries ends, you'll get a published copy of the trade paperback. So that's what I ended up doing. But, you know, which I'm psyched. You know, I love the fact that Dick Tracy is back. But, you know, in the past few weeks, Mad Cave Studios has also announced that they are doing a Flash Gordon miniseries, a Gatchaman miniseries, and perhaps most exciting to me, Defenders of the Earth with, you know, Mandrake the Magician, Flash Gordon, the Phantom, and, you know, the rest of the crew. Written by Dan DiDio with art by Jim Calafiori. So I'm like, whoa, this company has gotten the rights to all the things that I love that, you know, and what was it? What was the studio that did it? Dynamite had it a few years back, but now it's Mad Cave.
Yeah. So Paul, the history of Mad Cave, The company was formed in 2014, and they did basically a talent search and didn't start releasing books until 2018.
Oh, okay.
They've done three talent searches to line up their books, and they've been doing a bunch of books, including one set in during the 1990s wrestling era. It looks like right now their big thing is gathering properties.
I mean, the properties that scratch me right where I itch, because, you know, with the Defenders of the Earth and the Flash Gordon books that Dynamite was producing, you know, I think they were written by friend of the podcast, Jeff Parker, primarily. I loved those books. Loved those books. And the fact that they have the rights to those properties and Dick Tracy, I'm all in. I'm going to subscribe to all three of those books.
Yeah, I need to give Dick Tracy a chance because I haven't read even the first issue yet. I am really interested in the Gatchaman to see what they're going to do to modernize and update that.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like some of you have read Dick Tracy number one. And Gatchaman is written by Cullen Bunn, which is, I mean, pretty solid, writers here. But I'm quite enjoying the Dick Tracy book. It is definitely different than I expected, in that it's a bit darker. Characters die that I wouldn't have expected to die. It's a bit more violent than I thought, but like it's a modern take on it. You know, still set in the 30s era, but you know, much more modern storytelling technique. So I'm all on board for this Mad Cave Studios publishing company.
I think the thing that concerns me about Mad Cave Studios is that they don't release through Comixology, and so you have to get their digital copies on their site, right?
Yeah, which is a PDF, right? So they do send you PDFs, which is not my preferred reading.
I hate reading PDF.
Yeah, but I'd rather read PDF. This sounds horrible. I would rather read PDF than go to a comic store, dirty comic store like Andrew does.
I go to the cornerstone that created the comic book industry. Yeah, that's me. I'm the bad guy.
Keeping comics alive. Yeah. Well, and Wayne, just to kind of the Gatchaman series also offers a subscription equivalent. So it's five digital issues and one physical collected edition for $24.99, and you get the digital issues as they release. And I believe issue one may have already been released.
Yeah, I might just do that and wait and read the, like, I don't want physical media, except I don't mind trades.
Yeah.
Because I can put them on a bookshelf.
Yeah, exactly. That's not a bad price either. It's a little bit more than a trade, but you get the digital issues as well.
Yeah. And it's basically, if you think about it, the average comic is $4 or $5 even digitally anyway. So, you're getting essentially the trade paperback for free. So they've got a bunch of stuff coming. So I'm very curious of what they're going to do with these. And so Dick Tracy's already being published. Gatchaman appears to already be being published, and Flash Gordon is coming soon. And then Defenders of the Earth is later in the year.
I'm very much looking forward to Flash Gordon and Defenders of the Earth.
Me too.
Yeah.
Well, Aaron.
Sir, yes, sir.
It has probably been about 6 months. and I know this because I had to read six issues of this series this week since we last spoke about Jonathan Hickman and Valerio Skitty Sheedy Gods miniseries from Marvel Comics. And so, if you're not familiar with what Gods is, it's kind of
redefining, reimagining of the cosmic powers in the Marvel Universe. Mm-hmm. Jonathan Hickman sets up really two camps of powers. There is the natural order of things, and there are the powers that be. And each of them have avatars that wander around the Marvel Universe, representing their side of things. And the book, and this is what I kind of felt, Paul, and you jump in and disagree with me. It really kind of set up, this reimagining that I kind of felt like this was going to be a huge resetting of the table for Marvel. And it wound up not being that at all.
Yeah,
it certainly laid out, some new thoughts on the characters. So, like, for instance, there's a really kind of new and interesting take on the In-Betweener. that I really liked.
Yeah, I do too.
It really updated that character in a nice way. But it became a very personal story. In fact, I felt the last two issues of the series were deeply personal. Issue number 7 features the main character's sidekick, Dmitri. And we find out that Dmitri, who is of Russian descent, lost his parents when he was a boy, and he lost them on a space mission. And, you know, they were, you know, in orbit or whatever. And all of a sudden, a loud sound was heard across the radio waves, and their ship just disappeared. And so here he is, an adult, a practicer of magic, like his boss, Wynn. And he finally tracks down where his parents' lost spaceship is. It had slipped out of our reality and into another. And, you know, it's just a very personal story of how he grew up, how he tracked him down, and what he did to get him back. And I think issue 7 was my favorite of the series, to be perfectly honest. I thought it was really well done.
But it was also the point in the series in which I thought, it kind of feels like an odd side, you know, it kind of feels like an odd place in the series to have this, considering there's only one issue left. I'm like, there's quite a bit they have to resolve, you know, in this mystery and this stuff that they've set up. And I will say, I feel like I overall enjoyed the series, and I enjoyed, you know, kind of the deeply personal aspect of it. I'm enjoying this new era of Jonathan Hickman writing things a little bit more personal, a little less, you know, because he was a little less cosmic, a little more personal. Yeah. However, I feel like in this series, it was at the expense of a satisfying resolution.
Well, you know, the ending of the book, and we won't spoil it here, but it is not a definitive conclusion. It lets you ask, well, how does this end? Right. Yeah. I mean, it's very much a, well, what happened? And, you know, I know the intent is for you to figure it out. Right. You know, you to write your own ending, which I know can be frustrating for some. I thought this suited the story really well. And while it surprised me how personally this wraps up, I do think that it is telegraphed in the first issue. When you go back and you think about that first issue and how we as readers first meet Wynn and Aiko, I think that, you know, if you're thinking about it in more personal terms, you will arrive at that last issue. It just surprised me that that's where he went, because I didn't feel like that's what Hickman was setting up. I dug this a lot. I don't have any sense at all how successful this series was. I would love to see more with these characters. I thought the sacrifices the characters made were heartbreaking. There is a holy shit moment in issue 8 where you find out the price that Wynn had to pay. And I was, there's some great stuff. I really dug this book.
I think this book will read excellently in trade also.
Oh, absolutely. And I thought that at least midway through, I'm like, this is going to be a better book in trade. Because with the month break between each book, there is so much that goes on. I was kind of having to go back to the previous book to refresh.
To be fair, I pretty much read it in trade because I read 6 issues this week. But, you know, I really appreciated, you know, what they did in this story. I liked the new take on the Marvel cosmic characters and, you know, the order of things. And I do hope it's something that we see adapted elsewhere. You know, Hickman isn't writing 616 books right now. You know, he's focused on the Ultimate Universe, but if he does do some 616 stuff, I do hope that they incorporate some more of this. And I like, as much as I have enjoyed the Jeb, what is the writer's name? Jeb McKay. As much as I'm enjoying Jed McKay's, you know, take on Doctor Strange, I really like the way Hickman writes Doctor Strange.
I got to tell you, Valerio Schiti's artwork throughout this series has been superb.
Yeah.
I mean, you really can't ask for a better artist on your cosmic book. And the fact that he made the AIM soldiers look dangerous – you know, right. instead of comical. I mean, there's that scene where we pop into an AIM secret hideout, and I'm like, holy crap, these guys look like they're bad news. I mean, as opposed to just like, you know, comedic relief. I dug it. I really highly recommend this book. And, you know, Hickman's got such a great voice for cosmic, weird, abstract stuff. I mean, he would be a great pair to Steve Ditko, right? I mean, he just has a head for this stuff. And the fact that he pulled out Personal Threads and made this a really human story surprised the hell out of me. Just surprised the hell out of me. I dug it.
Yeah, agreed. And I do hope to, you know, that they do find a way to continue this series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I like the characters.
Well, you know, so from an ending in, you know, God's Number 8 to a new beginning, DC's Elseworlds are back with an official Elseworlds banner. And it's not like they really ever went away, but they weren't.
Oh, they went away, Paul.
The little Elseworlds logo went away, but it's back now. And it's starting with Batman Gotham by Gaslight, The Kryptonian Age, which is a successor to, obviously, there were two Batman Gotham by Gaslight books back in the day. And so, you know, this continues that thread. And Aaron, are you and I the only ones who read this book? I think that is
a correct statement.
Oh, okay. Well, I didn't mean to order our books in such a way that Wayne and Andrew haven't said anything for 20 minutes. But
yeah, I'm just going to leave when I'm done with this one.
So. Yeah.
No, I'm excited to hear about this one because I didn't know anything about the book. I didn't see it on Comixology when I was buying books, but just the title has me interested. I love Gotham by Gaslight, and if we're adding in anything Superman related, I want to hear about it.
Well, and I think so. That's what the intent of this book is to set up a DC universe set in that Gotham by Gaslight era, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, the Gotham by Gaslight, like I mentioned, there were two stories written way back in the day. They were written by Brian Augustine. The first one had art by Mike Mignola. That's really kind of one of the books that brought him to the forefront of, of DC artists. And so, you know, the original stories, you know, were focused on Batman. You know, the first one was, you know, battling Jack the Ripper. And this one kind of is setting up other characters in that, you know, I guess late 1800s, give or take.
Correct. Yeah. 1860 is where the story opens up.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Yeah. In that 1860s, you know, and beyond time frame. So, you know, we've got kind of the setup of Superman in this. We've got the setup of, you know, we have more than the setup, but we also get, you know, kind of the Gotham by Gaslight version of Catwoman. There's reference to the Al Ghul family. So, you know, there's a lot of action, but also a lot of setup in the book. And Aaron, I'm curious to hear your thoughts.
Well, it's hard to say that you liked this issue because it is all set up.
I would agree.
I thought the issue was fine. I was entertained. I'm in for number two. But it wasn't like I walked out of this book going, oh, God, this was so good. Because really not a lot happens. You know, we establish, you know, Martha and John Kent, you know, as pioneers riding across the Kansa tribal frontier. And, you know, the meteorite coming down that turns out to perhaps be an infant child rocketed to Earth from the dying planet Krypton. But, you know, of course, you don't see Superman yet. You don't even see little baby Kal-El. You just see, you know, the glowing from the vessel.
That sounds so perfect. I can just see Jonathan Kent as a pioneer.
The scenes that we get in Gotham, you know, the Wayne Foundation has acquired all of these Kryptonian artifacts, and it reads much like what we've seen so far is that Krypton is regarded as an ancient civilization. They're not saying that it's an ancient Earth civilization or an ancient outer space civilization. They're just referring to it as an ancient civilization. And look, we finally, for the first time, acquired all of these artifacts under one roof. And of course, Catwoman shows up to steal. And so that's the setup. You know, we do get to see a little bit of Batman in this story. We get to see, Talia al Ghul, because she through intermediaries had hired Catwoman to steal this ring from the Kandorian artifacts. Anyway, it's all set up.
And that's
I think it's setting up something really cool. I think the artwork is period appropriate. It's got a great sense of mood and atmosphere to it. I'm going to reserve judgment till issue two.
Yeah, agreed. I think the one thing that I will say is, and this is light spoilers, but not really. At one point, Batman in the book is shot by an arrow.
Mm-hmm.
And the storytelling on that for such a key part of the book is pretty terrible.
Agreed.
Because
the visual storytelling.
We see people with bows and arrows, and in the next shot we see Batman pulling the arrow out.
Yep.
And but he's jacked up on the last page of the book, for the cliffhanger. And I'm like, wait, when did he get shot by the arrow? You never actually see him get shot by the arrow. You see people holding arrows, you see Batman, what appears to be pulling it out, but the visual storytelling on that specific aspect of the book, and that's really the only part of the book I had an issue with. I just had to kind of, at one point Batman's on the floor bleeding, and I'm like, wait, when did that happen?
Because you had no sense prior to that he had been that grievously injured.
Yeah, agreed. So, so the Elseworlds are back, like I said. It starts with this, which is a 6-issue series. Obviously, they are rolling some other series into the Elseworlds banner, including Dark Knights of Steel and DC versus Vampires, which are both getting sequels in July and August. And then there's a couple of other miniseries. None of these appear to be one-shots.
I think they're all miniseries or ongoing series.
Yeah. So we're getting Batman the Barbarian, Green Lantern Dark, and Batman Nightfire.
They weren't so Batman heavy on these.
I do too. I would like a Superman one. Yeah. That would be nice. Maybe a Green Arrow one. But I do think, the three that are like Dark Knights of Steel, DC versus Vampires, and this Gotham by Gaslight will introduce other characters.
Yeah.
The fact that they're mostly focusing on Batman, it would be nice to see some other DC people get the spotlight. But I guess they're trying to get it off the ground strong.
Yeah, agreed. And Batman sells comics.
Yeah. Well, so Aaron, I think you can take a break.
Yeah, I'm gonna go ahead and clock out, guys.
Hey,
yeah.
Do you know what else sells comics, Paul?
Vampires.
Blood Hunt sells comic books.
It certainly sells them to us.
Yeah. Well, gosh, we are like. It's like this comic is blood and we are vampires, because I am buying like a stupid amount of tie-ins, more than I typically do for a Marvel crossover. Really?
Yeah. And it's all because of Aaron.
Also Aaron. I credit Aaron for all of this.
Stop.
Aaron's like, I am going to clock out. I think issue 3 was a transitional issue really for Blood Hunt. Not much. It's really, because it's only a 5-issue series, right? So it's not like we've got 7 issues. We're at the midway point, right? And this issue really kind of says, okay, here, now we've got 2 issues of nonstop action. Here's where the key players all are. Here's Captain America rallying the troops, and here's how the bad guys up the stakes on the last page. So that's, I think issue 3 was much more transitional. It was good. It wasn't quite the same impact as the first two, though.
I enjoyed it, but out of the 3 Blood Hunt books I read this week, I enjoyed the other two far more.
Well, and I find it interesting that now we're more than halfway into the series, and we still don't know what the hell is up with Blade.
Well, like, obviously, they're holding that off for the next issue.
Yeah.
But I will say, I feel like if you're going to tell someone that their father is responsible for all these horrible things, maybe you front load that statement by saying, Blade has been, your dad is not himself. Yeah. Blade has had.
Well, they don't know that really.
Right? No, there's a reference after that about how I think it was one of the Avengers after
Captain Marvel is very, she very much says that whatever it is that's wearing Blade's skin.
Right. That's what it was. Whatever's wearing Blade skin is not cool. Blade is cool. Whatever's wearing skin is not cool. So, yeah, I think I would front load that and be like, hey, we don't think your dad's right, but he is doing all these horrible things. But instead, they're just like, oh, yeah, you have to kill your own pops. with you know, maybe results that should have been anticipated. But no, you're right. It's transitional. There's not anything firm. It's the let's you know, circle the wagons. Let's go over what we know. Let's come up with a plan. Let's split back into small teams and then go out to do what needs to be done.
Well, they're setting up for a killer last two issues with Blade dropping the Temple of the First Blasphemy in the middle of Central Park, New York. I'm like, what is that?
Yeah. Yeah, I have no idea what that is. I didn't know if that was something that was that has existed in lore before, if that is new for this series, but I'm very intrigued by it.
Yeah, I found it interesting that in two books this week, we got a rallying speech. In Bloodhunt, we got the Falcon Cap giving his, you know, rallying speech to the people about the Avengers. And then in Avengers, you get Kate Bishop giving a speech, and they are both really good speeches that are very different. Yeah. I think my highlight of the week comment, though, is Kate Bishop's speech where as she's talking about, I shoot little sticks out of big sticks. And you know what vampires hate? Little sticks.
Well, I love that when Cap was given his speech, you know, there's all these little panels showing different parts of the world and what's going on there as he gives a speech across all communication channels. But you see that you know, Tigra, Hunter's Moon, and this mysterious third person that they refuse to name are in Asgard. So, like, what are they doing in Asgard? Surely the vampire plague isn't in Asgard, right? Then you see Doctor Strange's astral body and Clea showing up at Latveria. So that would imply we're going to see some Doctor Doom maybe in issue 4. Maybe it'll be in Doctor Doom's book. You see, you know, Black Panther beneath this cape. By the way, having read the Black Panther tie-in, there is in the first issue, there is no information about what he's searching for or anything about the temple, in case you were curious. So I'm very excited. These little snippets we get for what's coming up in those pages.
Yeah, and there's lots more Bloodhunt to come. I mean, you know, and Wayne, you read Jubilee number one, which I didn't even read, which I don't think either one of us read.
No, I did not.
Yeah, and the reason I picked it up was because of that
Free Comic Book Day.
Yeah, the little Jubilee story that was in there, I really enjoyed. So that's why I picked this up. And it was interesting because it was a callback to her time as a vampire. So she is fighting and killing vampires like crazy, but feeling guilty about every kill because she remembers being a vampire. And when, you get when, to meet.
When was she a vampire?
There was a crossover that they did, X-Men versus vampires, basically. Okay. And it was a war with Dracula, and she got turned.
Yeah, I think Victor Gishler did a relaunch of X-Men number one years ago. Victor Gishler was the writer on it. And it was very much like rooted in you know, X-Men versus vampires. It was 2010, 14 years ago.
Wow.
Curse of the Mutants was the name of the crossover.
That's right.
I'll have to check that out on
I actually quite enjoyed it.
Yeah, I recall Unlimited. Us covering that on this very podcast.
We did.
I do too. Yeah, and she was kind of badass as a vampire. But you get to see a little bit of her, like she's remembering what it was like and how to stay sane, you have to not drink human blood. And if you drink human blood, it turns you into the less sane versions of the vampires that we keep seeing. That is one thing that bothers me is all the vampires look very much not human.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit too far of a trans. Yeah, because when you get characters in like Blade books, when you're dealing with the vampire nation, you get a lot more human looking vampires. But I guess those tend to be the more powerful and older ones.
Yeah. Well, this way you don't have any issue with the heroes just destroying them. All of them. Yes,
yeah. Slaughtering them. But yeah, there's a whole group that Jubilee worked with that they call themselves the Forgiven. And they are a group of vampires that don't drink human blood. And they were the ones that helped Jubilee when she turned into a vampire. I didn't know any of these characters, but some of their designs are really cool. And in this book, Jubilee is out there saving people, but also finding young vampires and bringing them to this group to help them, getting to them before they've drank blood yet.
That sounds really cool.
Yeah, she's feeding them like rat blood so they can eat but not turn into the horrible evil versions.
So would you say it's worth picking up?
Definitely. It was my favorite of the three books this week. Oh. It was not as important to the story as the other books,
right?
But I just enjoyed it.
Well, it, you know, as much as Blood Hunt number 3 didn't have a lot of action, it sounds like Jubilee number 1 and Avengers 15 had enough action to make up for that.
Okay. Definitely.
Yeah. I did love watching Captain America, Steve Rogers Captain America, just wail on Baron Blood. And obviously they got some issues they got to deal with, but I did enjoy the Avengers 15 quite a bit.
Well, Aaron, you can come back now.
Are you tapping me back in?
I'm going to tap out because I did not get a chance to read Get Fury number 2.
Who's my Get Fury buddy this
week? I read Get Fury number 2.
Oh, very good. Well, what did you think, Andrew?
Well, I did find it interesting. You know, they show us, we talked last time at Get Fury number 1 about kind of the graphic nature. I did like how in this one they decided to spare us from watching the plane blow up. You know, you see the missile heading towards it, and then they just cut away, and you're like, okay, that you're going to keep from us. But a guy getting his head cut open, that you're going to show in great detail.
And don't forget, you know, rubbing Nick Fury's face into the guy's entrails.
Oh, right. You know? While he's still alive, while the dying person is still talking.
It's the
results of the bombing campaign. But what I really liked about this, I like how they dealt with how is Frank Castle going to wander around Hanoi, where he looks completely out of place. I also really liked how in the original, you know, the plot line of the first book is Fury knows too much. We can't rescue him. We got to take him out. I like how they added some layers of duplicity and complexity to that storyline in this issue.
I do too. And, you know, I thought that they were clever solutions to the problems that were in the character's way. What you were talking about, how Frank Castle gets around, you know, Hanoi with, you know, looking like a giant 6'4" American, you know, I thought that was very clever. I didn't see that solution coming.
It never even occurred to me that could be a way for him to get around, but go on.
Yeah. But what I also liked is when he is presented with a problem, you know, we see the Punisher as the guy who's just always ready to kill, right?
Right.
And you can tell he didn't want to kill this guy.
Right.
He is, you know, talking to one of the North Vietnamese guys, and the North Vietnamese guy go, well, you know, really, thanks for sharing, you know, your cigarettes with me, and it was great having this conversation, but I really need to see your papers. I have to see your papers. I'm going to get in a lot of trouble if I don't see your papers. And Frank's like, you know, I forgot them. Is there any way that, you know, we can do this without the papers? You know, I really got to see your papers. And, you know, you can just tell Frank really didn't want to kill this guy. I think he might even kind of like the guy.
Yeah, I think they bonded a little bit.
Yeah. And, you know, he's just like, OK. there is a bit of the funny about that. But there's also just that's tragic, you know, that, you know, Frank's only out there to kill the bad guys. And he didn't see that guy as a bad guy.
Because this guy's just a police officer, right? He's not doing his job. Opposing troop, you know, he's there protecting his family. Yep. He's trying to give the guy a break. You know, it's after curfew, but the North Vietnamese guy is trying to give him a break. But he's like, okay, if you have to see him, hold on.
I do think that another fun moment in the book is how much the CIA guys have screwed this up.
Oh yeah,
and it's just starting to dawn on them. Oh God,
what have we done? I feel like, and maybe I'm wrong, I feel like there's going to come a point, maybe, at least I hope maybe there's going to come a point where that general just takes out his sidearm and just puts both of them in the ground.
Yeah,
like, just
kills both of those guys. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like, because this general, I feel obviously the general's not a good guy either, but I feel like he's just been mistreated. He's been abused by these CIA guys, and he's just like two seconds away from snapping.
Yeah.
You know, he's too old for this shit, to put it a different way.
Exactly. Exactly.
But no, it was great. I loved Get Fury number 2. I do like that they made the storyline more complex as far as why this is all going on beyond the action you know, part of it with Fury and Castle. I like what's going on back at the base.
Completely agree. I think it's a great story. And I'm enjoying, you know, the clever solutions to problems that the characters are facing. And it's just a mark of just great writing. So keep it up.
Absolutely. Keep it definitely up. And do we know how many issues this is going to be?
I have no idea.
Okay. Well, I'm in.
Zero.
I'm in,
zilch.
I'm into the end.
Same.
Well, I'll have to get caught up in time for next issue.
Yes, Paul. Yes, you will.
I will. Paul.
Yeah, this will show up on your quarterly performance review.
That's right. Well, Andrew and I read last week, Scarlet number one came out from Image Comics and Skybound, kind of continuing the G.I. Joe part of the Energon universe. So the first two series have ended. What were they? They were Duke and Cobra Commander. Right. And now we have Scarlet, and Destro comes out, I think, next week.
Next week, Destro number one.
Yes. Looking forward to talking about that one. But we've got Scarlet number one this week. And Andrew, I have to tell you, well, first, I love the issue.
Yes. But
second, I totally missed that, you know, on the cover, it shows Scarlet front and center. And I'm like, cool.
You missed that thing down in the right, like the lower right corner.
Yes, I missed the thing on the lower right corner. So when we got to the last page of the book and freaking Storm Shadow shows up, I'm like, fuck yes. Yes. I am all in.
I love this issue. I love what they're setting up. This kind of reimagining of the relationship between Jazz and Scarlet. You know, the whole introduction of Ashikage.
Ashikage plan.
Yeah, I love them bringing it into the Energon universe. I love seeing Storm Shadow for a few minutes. And, you know, Jazz is, you know, she has that symbol on her thigh, I guess, the left thigh.
Yeah.
It has that same type of tattoo, the Ashikage tattoo, I believe it is. I love seeing Snow Job show up. There's not a single page in this book that I did not love. The action sequences were very well drawn. I'm so excited about it.
And I'm honestly a little sad that Wayne didn't get a chance to read it, because Wayne, this is 100% up your alley, this book.
I remember the preview pages look really good, and I did pick up the book. I haven't had a chance to read it, but I will, because I am looking forward to it.
Well, and, you know, one of the things I really like on these first issues for these books is the letter. The writers kind of do a little essay at the back. So I believe Duke and Cobra Commander were both written by Joshua Williamson. I think he's, you know, kind of the one running, whereas Daniel Warren Johnson's writing Transformers. I think Joshua Williamson will be writing G.I. Joe. But Destro and Scarlet are written by different writers. They're not written by him. And so this one's written by Kelly Thompson. And she goes into, you know, I like her essay at the back of the book, because she kind of talks about how important Scarlet is to the G.I. Joe, you know, fan base, and, you know, kind of her, you know, how important she was for her. And I'm like, you know, like, you know, I was into G.I. Joe as a boy, as a young male, you know, preteen, you know, like 8 years old, seven, 8 years old. I was into G.I. Joe. So I could give a shit about Scarlet, right, when I was a kid. But I can see why she was such a big deal, right? And especially in that era, and especially in that environment. And the introduction of her in this series, almost, you know, as kind of like a female James Bond super spy, I thought was badass. I thought they did a really fantastic job making her a character that was appropriately badass. And like you said, tying her quote unquote origin story in with the Ashikage clan. I am all in on the series. Plus, I love the art. Just, you know, the art is 100%. Like, Marco Ferrari is the artist on this book. I love the way he draws people, you know, characters and action. So I'm all in on this book.
I love how they kind of naturally worked in a crossbow scene with her too. Like, you know, she's not carrying crossbows around, but they found a way in this first issue to get her with a crossbow in her hands doing badass stuff with it. So, I cannot say enough good things about the Energon universe. Obviously, I'm more of the G.I. Joe guy, but I've even been enjoying Transformers. You know, issue 9 was a week or two ago, and I'm still digging it. So I am very excited to see where Scarlet goes. Because, you know, if we're seeing Storm Shadow, we're seeing the Ashikage, What, Paul, do you think the odds are that we're going to see Snake Eyes by the end of the Scarlet series?
Oh, we're going to have to. We're going to have to see Snake Eyes before the end of this. So
I think so.
I cannot wait for, you know, obviously, in, you know, with Destro coming out and Scarlet, like, I don't know if these are the last two or if there will be more before we get to G.I. Joe. But I cannot wait for G.I. Joe.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you've noticed. You probably have. Have you seen these ads for Skybound's Kickstarter for these hardback reprints of the original G.I. Joe series?
I have the compendium. That's but it's like $300.
If you want all three volumes, it's $300. If you want just like one, the first one, it's $75. And you can pick whether you want it in like G.I. Joe Green or Cobra Red. It's if I just had money laying around, I would have already bought them. But
yeah, they're it's pretty badass.
Yeah, it's I've been seeing some online. I've been seeing a lot of pictures from the original art from the original series, and it just takes me back to my childhood. But the Scarlet, Duke, Cobra Commander, probably Destro, they're all doing a great job of bringing the next kind of generation iteration of G.I. Joe to probably a whole new fan base, I hope.
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, Wayne's reading them, so.
True.
He was not a G.I. Joe fan, so.
Yeah, I don't know any of these characters from other media at all. This is my first introduction to Scarlet, and those preview pages and what I've been reading while you guys have been talking about it have been just badass.
Yeah. And I feel the same way with Transformers. I don't know a lot of the Transformers. I don't know a lot of the backstory, but I've really enjoyed reading the Transformers book as well.
Yeah.
Hey, Paul.
Yes, sir.
What's coming out next week?
Well, Blood Hunt. More Blood Hunt?
Yes. So obviously more Blood Hunt comes out from Marvel Comics. We get the second issue of Dracula Blood Hunt. We also get the newest Doctor Strange issue, which is written by Jed McKay. So, very much ties in with what's happening in the Blood Hunt book. From Marvel Comics, we also get the latest issue of Ultimate Spider-Man, issue 6, which is the conclusion of the first arc. Looking forward to that. The biggest release from Marvel Comics next week, however, is a new book from Jason Aaron. It is Uncle Scrooge and the Infinity Dime.
I can't wait for that one.
I cannot freaking wait.
I cannot wait for that. Yeah.
Color me interested.
Yeah. We have Uncle Scrooge and the Infinity Dime, and it was announced this week that there is another one-shot coming later this year. What if Donald Duck
had the power
of Thor?
Yeah. I gotta say, Uncle Scrooge gets me right where I itch. That was one of the early books I read when I was first started reading comic books. I love Uncle Scrooge. Yeah,
Uncle Scrooge is probably one of my favorite characters of all time in any media. So I'm super psyched for the book. So that's from Marvel Comics. As we've already mentioned from Image Comics, we get the first issue of Destro number one. And we also get Redcoat number three from Image Comics and Ghost Machine. And from DC Comics, we get the latest issues of Nightwing, continuing the second in the second chapter of Fallen Grayson. And, the latest issue of Batman, which is leading up to the big Absolute Power crossover.
Very exciting. Well, hey, we want to know what you thought about this week's books. What do you think of The Acolyte? Give us a shout at ideologyofmadness@gmail.com. And if we use your comments on the show, you could win a coveted, valuable Ideology of Madness surprise.
You can also hit us up on social media, IOM Geek, on Facebook, Instagram, and X.
All right, guys, we should be taking bets on what the internet will be outraged about next week in episode 4 of The Acolyte. I'm taking bets right now, so...
I'm sure there'll be something.
You know there will.
Yeah. All right, folks. Well, we will see you then.
You guys have a good one.
Podcast theme music graciously provided by Mark Andrew Pope. For more information, visit markandrewpope.com. Funny Books with Aaron and Polly is a production of ideologyofmadness.com. No Spider-Man clones were harmed in the production of this podcast.